Good morning, everyone. We're in Genesis chapters 22 and 23 as we survey the book of Genesis, looking at a lot of the material, but any kind of situation like this, you're only looking at highlights. So you can turn there. We'll dive right back in and see what's happening with Abraham. We're starting to sort of wrap up Abraham's life a little bit and see what happens in this next period of what he's doing. Ken, could you lead us in a prayer as we start, please?
Our great and holy God, we're thankful to you for another day that you've given to us, and another opportunity to gather together here and study from your word. We'd ask that you would help us to put aside all the things that distract us from our study today, that we would seek to know more about you, to understand you better, especially your great power and might, love and care. We'd ask that you be with all the classes this day. Help each of them to do that. Please look down upon us and forgive us for those times that we have given in to temptation and sinned against you. Help us to make it a point in our lives that we strive to never, ever sin to the very best of our ability. Thank you for all that you do each day. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So working off the theme that we used in last week's sermon about Abraham's journey of faith, though of all Bible characters, I would imagine that Abraham in the Old Testament and Paul in the New Testament is so associated with journeying. You could say Moses too. There's a lot there with Moses, but especially there's a point made, a real point of emphasis about Abraham, that his real journey was faith. Well, that journey of faith doesn't get any easier as time goes on. And that brings us to chapter 22. And this incident in chapter 22 reminds us of something, and that is, in trying to look at these kinds of incidents, we've got to remember the very basic truth that God is God. We're not in his position. We don't have his power, abilities, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. And to some extent, us trying to ascertain what God's up to is equivalent to an ant on the ground looking up at us and trying to figure us out. Now, what we have that the ant doesn't have is communication. God communicates with us, and thus he does reveal some things, and thus we have some quite a bit to go on, but still we've got to remember that chasm between us and God. So Genesis chapter 22, let's look here at what takes place. I've got a gimpy foot, so I'm just going to say it, so don't worry about it, but I'm going to have to get on that stool, okay? Hopefully I won't trip over that stool and hurt the other foot, so there we go. Ray Conies, can you read Genesis 22 verses 1 to 9, please?
After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And he said, Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, My father. And he said, Here I am, my son. He said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood.
All right, thank you. The Bible does a masterful job in the narrative sections in isolating events, details, and dialogue that speak volumes. I mean, we're looking at Abraham's life. He's a man at this point. He's over 100 years old. And his story is told on just a few pages. And this incident, the verses that Ray just read, they really slow down. And there are details provided. Little observations, noting of something he's doing, Isaac's doing, something that Abraham's saying or that Isaac is saying. And so the text really slows down and looks at this at fairly a micro scale. And that's telling us something. Slow down and look at this closely. If the narrative itself is structured in a way that it slows down and gives you details, then do that. He makes the journey from Ur to Haran, Haran to Canaan, and we don't have any details. I mean, how many camels did he use? What were they saying to each other on the journey? I'm hot. I'm thirsty. I don't know what they're saying. We have none of that. And you know how long that would have taken? That would have taken months. But here, this is a matter of 3 days. But there are moments at the onset of the 3 days and at the end of the 3 days where details are really shown here. Now, some older translations say in verse 1 that God tested Abraham after these things. Tempted Abraham. Some older translations use the word tempt. When we think of tempt, and thus it's used in other places like this, especially the New Testament, tempting means to try to entice someone to do something wrong, to commit an offense, a sin. This word really means, and that's why some latter translations render this as test, prove, or try. It means to prove or try something. It's like if you're testing a car, test drive. Or you'll see something in a store and they'll have it set up on display and you can test it. You can try it out, see what it's like, what it does. And so that's the connotation here. Abraham's being tested. You would think, has this man been tested enough? Or that's what you and I would think. He's over 100. Let him cruise. That's what you and I would think, right? Because if you think about this, it made no sense at all that a 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman would have a baby. But it makes even less sense that after having that child, what? Isn't that even more mind-blowing? It is. How is child sacrifice viewed in the Old Testament? Outside of this text,
God never commanded it. When the heathens were doing it, and it never entered God's mind to tell his children to do it.
Right. Never called on them to sacrifice that. You have these details about things they would sacrifice, lambs and oxen and bulls, and bring drink offerings, you know, the oil and of the olive and things such as that, grain offerings. There's all kinds of things they were commanded to offer, but never their own children. And actually, it's heavily, heavily condemned, and is really one of the great atrocious sins of the people of Canaan that God would bring judgment upon them and put the Israelites there. So there's that. But I think that I would propose to you in some way that as students of the New Testament and followers of Jesus, that we actually can maneuver this a little better than even Abraham. Obviously, it's not our child. But watch how that there are phrases in this incident. There's terminology even, such as take your son, your only son, the son whom you love. And we'll see more of this. That terminology just is reminiscent of what?
John 3:16.
That's right. Jesus, the Son, being given by God. And of course, in that text, John 3:16, there's all this emphasis on Jesus being the only begotten, the only one of God, the only one like God that's given. But then the emphasis in John 3:16 is not so much on God's love for the Son, but God's love for the world, that he would give his only Son. And that's the thing here. And you know this, Moriah is in the vicinity of Jerusalem. And let me ask you, before when God would talk to Abraham about what was going to happen, Abraham would have conversation with God, wouldn't he? Did he ever question things? Yeah. Was he ever puzzled and expressed that to God? Yeah. Is there any questioning, discussion, or resistance on Abraham's part in this text? There's not. It's just a complete obedience. And then there's another expression that he took the wood, and where was the wood placed for the fire? On Isaac. The wood was placed on the son. The son carried the wood that would be the mechanism of his supposed death. And what's that like? The cross. And then the expression, God will provide for himself the lamb. God will provide the offering, my son. God will provide the lamb. When John the Baptist, in the book of John, introduces Jesus, he says, behold, the what? The Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. I would have you see that, yes, Abraham is being tested. I want you to see that the real purpose of this text is to introduce the sacrifice of the Son of God. Because, first of all, Abraham's not called to go through with it. So there is no practical reason for this to happen. It is all a demonstration. And it was initially a demonstration of Abraham's submission to God. But, and that's important in Abraham's life. But, hey, this is comfortable. I may stick with this. But there are so many tie-ins. And this is so puzzling, I would have you see that it's meant to be puzzling. Because the most puzzling thing in the universe is the love of God. That's the most puzzling thing ever. So, okay, before we get ahead of ourselves, Rick, which one is that?
Well, Kerry Keenan told me a story one time about he was studying with a woman, an older woman, and he was studying this passage, and she was just incredulous that God would ask Abraham to do this and really angry about it. And when Kerry explained to her what this was really showing, he said that woman got tears in her eyes, realizing what God did for us.
That's what you call the gospel. That's what you call the power of the gospel to salvation, Romans 1:16. And when I was doing my research for this class, I ran across a statement that said that Genesis was closer to the New Testament than any Old Testament book. And I thought to myself, okay, I've never heard it put that way. And it made me think, and you got all these prophecies, and like Isaiah about the Messiah and Jeremiah. But the more I thought about it, that's a, you know, trustworthy statement, as Paul would say. And then, and maybe I'm making a little bit too much out of this in the English framework, because the Hebrew framework would be different. But he says here, when Isaac wonders where the animal is, and Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb. God will provide the offering, my son. That might just be a play on words. God will provide the offering. His son. I don't think you can squeeze too much out of this one. That, you know, I don't think you can't over-squeeze this passage about Christ.
It's interesting that he gives them a ram. He doesn't give them a lamb, which is what they were used to sacrificing.
Yeah.
The lamb comes later in the New Testament.
It's true. It is ram.
Well, there's 3 days. There's two other men.
3 days. right? Two other sort of witnesses to this. Yeah, you just keep working it.
Sure can. Now, I've always wondered about Isaac. I'm going to start, Lord willing, I'm going to start a series on Jacob next Sunday. Five sermons. I plan five sermons on Jacob. Because I think Jacob is an under-treated subject in the book of Genesis and in the Old Testament. After all, they're called the children of Israel, and Jacob was Israel. And I've wondered about Isaac, because Isaac's not mentioned a lot later on in the Bible. You know, Jacob is Israel, or Jacob is Abraham is over and over and over. Even quite a few references to Joseph later on, and aptly so. Isaac, what's up with Isaac? And Isaac's treated very lightly in the Genesis text. We'll see it in the coming weeks. But he's there. But I want you to think about Isaac. You know, sometimes we think the worth of our life is in some kind of wide span. But I think sometimes it's just moments. I don't mean moments like seconds. But what if Isaac's behavior here? What's he saying and how's he acting? He's very submissive. And he cannot be a small boy. We don't know exactly. There's some speculation at what his age is. Based on the conversation, based on carrying the wood and just different things, he's not a toddler. He is either an older boy or a young teen. Abraham is over 100. Do you think Isaac could have made a dash for it? Of course he could. Isaac is perfectly submissive in this. And the fact that he's wondering about the animal shows he comprehends how this is supposed to work, and he's perplexed by it. He notices that. Says something of his age. He's saying, we trust God to provide. But there's a matter of trust. Isaac, I want you to see that Isaac is the picture of trust and submission. So in this case, Isaac is symbolic of whom? Jesus. Sure.
But Abraham also says that they're going to go and worship and they will return.
Okay, there you go. Abraham's called to do this, but Abraham has not given up the belief that Isaac is the son of promise. So somehow he's going to come back with him. And we'll talk about the Hebrews 11 passage in a moment. Yeah. So look what happens next here. Daryl, can you read verse 10 to 14, please?
And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold him, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, in the mouth of the Lord it will be provided.
Thank you. Note how that, and it happens a couple other times, an angel is acting for God here and communicating with Abraham and even speaking in the first person for God. When it says there, verse 11, the angel of the Lord called, and then he said, don't lay your hand on the boy or do anything for him, for I know that you fear God, God's second person, seeing you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me, first person. So watch how that angels, especially in the book of Genesis, when they're speaking, they may be carrying a message for God, but sometimes they're such an important messenger, they're speaking for God, which is like the prophets do that. The prophets will speak about God. God will do this and this. And then sometimes the prophets will say, and the Lord says, and they'll speak in the first person as if God is speaking through them. Same thing here. The angel is like a prophet in that regards. And he says here in verse 12, you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me. There's that emphasis again. Flip over to Romans 8:32. Becca, will you do that? Romans 8:32. You're off your crutches now, so you can move fast. Romans 8:32. Romans 8:32. I want you to think about this statement of Paul in this great chapter about salvation. I want you to look at it in light of what was said right there. Romans 8:32, please.
He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things?
Thank you. So the point of this text is to show that God cares for us and he's going to be there for us and he's going to help. And the basis of trust in that is that he did not withhold his only son. Again, language that goes right back to Genesis 22. Genesis 22 may just very well be the most messianic section in the whole book of Genesis. We think of Genesis 3 as very messianic, and it is, but Genesis 22, so messianic. Top to bottom, through and through. Yeah.
I had a Bible class teacher that told us one time God loved Abraham enough to spare his son, but God loved us enough to not spare his own.
Right. That's what brings us to this dilemma. It's not about what Abraham is doing or having to maybe do here. The ultimate thing is what it reflects regarding what God did. And then there's the ram caught in the thicket. Do you think in rural Palestine, do you think that rams got caught in thickets occasionally? Of course they did. It's not unusual for a ram to be caught in the thickets with his horns. What is unusual about this is what? The timing. The perfect timing. It's not unusual for a man to ride a chariot through Gaza in the first century. But it was the timing of Philip showed up right when the eunuch was there. It was timing, right? So this just drips with the sacrifice of Jesus, the Son of God. Now, back to this thing, and this is the point that he's making in his anecdote there about carrying and even Becca's point, one might say, what kind of God is this? But to call upon a man to sacrifice his child, especially in light of other things said in the Old Testament about such a practice, and on top of that, to sacrifice this child of all children, right? Well, three things here. First of all, God gave Isaac to Abraham. It was really, in a way, Isaac who's the son of God. Now, I don't mean the son of God. I mean a son of God. Our children are gifts. They're loaned to us. They belong to God. They're his offspring. And if you don't believe it in the normal case, this case being so unusual, a man 100 and a woman 90, only God does that, right? So, first of all, let us understand some basics here. It's God that provided the son to begin with. And let us remember, he didn't require Abraham to go through with it. Which indicates he never intended Abraham to go through with it. So why would he put him through this? So there's our dilemma, right? That's the sticking point. Which forces us to say, what is this really about? Which then, when you understand the unfolding of the Bible, this is about God sacrificing his son. So this question, what kind of God is it, would demand the sacrifice of a man's son. When you really get to scratching beyond the surface of this, the question is not that. The question is, what kind of God would sacrifice his own faithful son for us sinners? That's the real question. Because you see, Abraham didn't go through with that. He didn't have to. God wouldn't let him. God went through with his sacrifice. And I love that term that you use, Rick, about the lady being incredulous. Our incredulous reaction to, why did God make Abraham do this? That same kind of emotional stirring should be directed to, why would God do that for us? It's incredulous that God would sacrifice his son for us. God didn't stop the sacrifice of his son, even when his son did what the night before? asked him to. Now chew on that for a while. That's a piece of leather. The real dilemma of this text, it's not about what God called Abraham to do, it's what God did in his son, with his son. That's the real dilemma, is that love of God. And then there's that statement in Hebrews 11, and Joe, you're pulling that. Would you turn over there and look at that? Hebrews 11, verse 19. We mentioned this in the sermon last week, but I know I don't remember everything I preached last week, so how would I expect you to remember it, okay? But Hebrews 11, we made the point last week, I do remember saying this, that this gives us insight into Abraham's thinking, which gave him the fortitude to do this, and it's insight into how deep his faith went. So Hebrews 11, 19, what does it say about it, Joe?
Concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense.
Okay. That helps explain why he said to the young men, we'll be back, right?
Yes.
Okay. So why would why would Abraham have the faith that if he sacrificed Isaac, God would raise him up? Why would he make that conclusion?
Because of God's promise.
Because of God's promise over and over and over and over and over. He's going to have descendants, he's going to have a son, he's going to have a son through Sarah, and you're going to have a son through Sarah, you're going to call Isaac. It's all riding on Isaac. So if Isaac dies and stays dead, the promises are done for. They're voided. So he makes the conclusion driven by faith. It's not just intellectual, you know, this is so and this is so, so this must be so, logical kind of conclusion, but rather it's driven by faith. Isaac has to live. So even if Isaac dies, as Hebrews 11, 19 says, he will live again. So Rick and Earl.
Well, it took Abraham 100 years to really learn to trust God's word, because he was waffling at times. You know, hey, well, it must be, you know, maybe this is Ishmael. Maybe this is it. Maybe it's...
No. This act shows he knows Isaac is the son of the promise. Because you'd only sacrifice your child if you knew your child wouldn't stay dead.
Resurrection from the dead is not such a foreign concept to us, because we read about,
right,
you know, in the New Testament about people being resurrected from the dead. But there's nothing in the Old Testament up to this point for Abraham to reference. This idea of resurrection from the dead was completely foreign to him. And yet he believed that God would.
Am I right? The only case we have in the Old Testament is way into the divided kingdom with the case of Elisha. Right? I don't know of another one before then. I don't know of one after that. It's the woman that was Barron's son. That was him, yeah.
Not to this point.
I mean, it's way... I mean, that's like 700 B.C. And this is 2000 B.C., roughly, okay? So, to Earl's point, piggyback your point. What's the big emphasis in Genesis? What's the looming fact? If you eat of this tree, you will die. And then we have person after person born and then dies. So by this point, the reality of death is so drilled into them, right? So why would he think he would resurrect? The only way he would conclude that is because he believes in the promise of Isaac being the son of promise. You're talking about faith. Yeah.
He made the statement that we'll return. So he knew that he was going to bring back Isaac. But for the time that they were traveling, I wonder if he thought about he was going to have to be the one to sacrifice him, to offer him. Even if he did get him back, he was going to be the one that killed
him. Yes, yes, he had the knife. Did you see that? Isaac carries the wood. Abraham carries the fire and the knife. Christ carried the cross, but ultimately it was the Father who had him put to death.
If we don't read the Old Testament with an eternal perspective, then we can't understand really what's going on with things like this and a lot of the other things we see, that this is not about what's going on. And so many people want to judge God from what justice in this world.
Yeah.
They're not looking beyond this world and what eternity really means.
Boy.
And isn't Joseph one of the best characters that has that perspective? Joseph has the long-term perspective, doesn't he? It's one of the things that makes him stand out. It really does. Okay. Great. So, look what happens next here. Just a timely time thing here. Elaine, would you read 22:15-19, please?
Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba.
All right, thank you. Once again, we have God doing what to Abraham? And we have several of these peppered throughout the Abraham narrative.
He's reiterating the promise.
Making the promises about a descendant, creating descendants, okay, numerous and very important. There's something different here, though. What's different about the promise here that you don't see earlier in the promises? There's a basis for the promise this time. What is it?
Because you have obeyed my voice.
Because you obeyed me. Now, God doesn't say that in Genesis 12. You know, get out of your country, away from your kindred, and the land I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. He doesn't say, "All right, Abraham, if you do A, B, C, this is what I'll do." There are no conditions. The promise was unconditional. What do you make of that here? That now it was Abraham's faithful obedience that prompts God to say this. What do you think? How would you understand this? Which one's true, the earlier promises or this one, that there's a condition? Right, they're all true. Excellent.
Well, God knew what Abraham was going to do.
I mean, God is going to do some things unconditionally, but also our response affects what he does too. And if nothing else, this shows, can we say this? After talking so much about Abraham's faith in God, can we say this? That now, God really has faith in Abraham. And isn't that why God's wanting? Isn't he wanting a reciprocal relationship? Isn't he wanting us to love him because he loves us? And isn't he wanting us to trust him so that we can become the person that he trusts?
That's what it's all about, right? Free will.
So, right? Freely doing it. And that's a real relationship.
This is Job.
It is Job.
You considered my servant Job? He's not. He's going to stand by me. Right.
He trusted Job, didn't he? Yeah.
And the encouraging thing about this is Abraham's growing. As time goes on, he's growing. His faith is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And if we are striving to be what we ought to be, as we grow older, hopefully our faith is growing stronger and we're trusting more in God, and God has also been able to trust more in us and have confidence that we're going to do what we need to do.
Shouldn't that be our goal, right? I want to be the kind of person that God can depend on. That's a real relationship. A real relationship when you know you can depend on that person. And then here's the beauty. You know that they know they can depend on you. That's a sweet spot. I ran across a statement by a commentator on this text, Derek Kidner, who produces some really good stuff on the Old Testament. And he, just a little statement that just caught my eye. And he said, the test, speaking of Abraham's test here, the test, instead of breaking him, stop right there. Can you imagine what Abraham could have said? God, after all that we have been through down here, waiting on this son, now you want me to kill him? Now, is that a logical response? Absolutely it is. It's a natural response for a parent. But Kidner says, the test, instead of breaking him, brings him to the summit of his lifelong walk with God. Kidner nailed it on that, because really everything after this is just sort of, there are no more Abraham incidents where there's a struggle or he has to learn something. This is the summit. And think about summit. This is at Mount Moriah. This is the high hill country of Judea. And I'm going to add to this thought here, and I get you, Vince. This is the place of the summit relationship. This is geographically representing the summit of Abraham's relationship with God. But doesn't this same location and the summit nature of it represent the summit of God's relationship with humankind? Because that's where God demonstrated his love and sacrificed his son. And if we would come to that summit, if we would come to that cross, then we find God and we find salvation. It's the summit relationship. That's just such a great expression. Vince?
I agree with that. I was just putting to mind how Abraham was pleading with God or discussing with God when God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And he said, well, if you find 50 righteous, he was concerned about that.
Yeah.
And you're right, he has grown faithfully, like Earl said, he's grown faithfully this whole time to fully trusting God.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. Great point. I had thought about Sodom and Gomorrah when I was thinking this.
I get so frustrated with our denominational friends who want to preach faith only and faith plus nothing. You never see faith plus nothing in the scriptures. It's faith plus things like this.
All of Hebrews 11 is.
That's every one. They did something.
By faith, they...
Yeah. And there's also another little subtle distinction. Verse 18, you may call back in Genesis 12. It was when God made the promise to Abram, through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Here in verse 18, it says what?
All nations.
All nations of the earth. And the nations there, don't think like we think of nation states. This term nation there really represents like ethnic classes. It's like races of people or ethnic classes. The idea of a nation state is not quite formulating at this point. And so all families and all races, that's what it's saying. And then you see the gospel being sent to all nations, right? All people, the whole world. Okay? All right, let's look at Sarah's death here real quickly. Earl, can you read verse 1 to 4? 23, 1 to 4.
Now it came about... Oh, 23, excuse me.
Yeah, 22.
Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Aram and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Then Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight.
All right, thank you. Sarah was actually younger than Abraham by 10 years. Remember that? But she dies first. And real quickly here, I just can't pass this up. The end of verse 2 indicates what Bible people did. When somebody died, what did they do? They mourned. Mourning is a fundamental human experience. And faith in God does not exclude that. Faith in God does not mean your mourning's any less. But what do you see Abraham doing? He's mourning, that's his emotional state, but what is he doing? He's burying her. He's moving on. And that is the other fundamental thing one has to do. And grief is very personal, and the time frame is very personal. But that's what Bible people did. They mourned, and then they moved on. And if you don't do one or the other, it's a mistake. If you don't stop and mourn, if you don't feel it, if you don't embrace your emotions, if you don't let it hurt you, you got to let it hurt you. You got to feel it. And then you just keep going. I think that's the essence of grief counseling right there. You got to let it hurt you. You got to embrace it. And then you got to take steps forward. You got to do both.
That I may bury my dead out of my sight. You think that was so that because the hurt was so deep that he didn't want to be reminded?
I don't know. I'd have to ponder that. But I think it's just an expression for the age. Here's why. There was no embalming like we have today. Burial had to be soon. Or the physical consequences were very disturbing. So you got to get them buried and get them buried out of sight. And that's my initial response to that. Okay? But I'm sitting down, so I'm probably not at my best.
Well, it kind of goes with what you were saying about moving on, though.
It does.
I mean, I remember we used to go to visit Benita's after her dad died. Go to the cemetery. There was a man that was out there in a lawn chair. I mean, 2 years, I think, I was seeing him out there at his wife's tombstone, I presume.
On a regular basis.
On a regular basis, and it was sad.
It's a mistake not to do either one. You got to do both. So let's talk about this. This is really a fascinating little incident here. First of all, note how Abraham describes himself in verse 4, sojourner and foreigner, which is what Hebrews 11 calls him in verse 13 to 16. He has that mentality of a sojourner. And then we're not going to read it, but starting in verse 5, he's not asking for a freebie, is he? What's he wanting to do? Pay for a burial plot, okay? A site. Usually it's in a rock tomb in this time and age and place. So the Hittites want to do what? They just want to give it to him. Why? What does it say in verse 6? They call him a what? A mighty prince of God. See, God said to Abraham, I'll make... Nobody in Canaan even knew Abraham. God said, I'll make what? Your name great. Abraham was a great man. You know why? Because God made him a great man.
Yeah. Well, David didn't accept that that threshing floor. He wanted to pay for it also.
Right. Exactly, yeah. So the Hittites were really a group that had migrated into Canaan, and they were a specific group from north of Canaan. But the term Hittite sort of became common for like synonymous with Canaanite. The Hittites really had a high view of Abraham, didn't they? But Abraham is determined to pay for it. He even wants a certain place, but he's determined to pay for it. Now, I want you to think about this. You pair it with the Lot incident. And even we haven't looked at it, but chapter 21, the Abimelech incident where there was a dispute about a well. Consistently, what does Abraham do when he has interactions with people regarding physical things? Yeah, is he trying to squeeze a great deal? He gives Lot what? He gives Lot choice of the land. He pays Abimelech for a well that actually his men had dug, but to make sure that Abimelech will not dispute that well, he gives him animals for it. Here, he will not take this burial plot free. He pays for it. That's what faith does. It creates a person with character. And if there is one way people can smell your character, is when it comes to things and how you treat them. We're way past time. Got to go on. Thank you very much.